Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 301 for Friday, May 9th, 2014. I am recording early this week on Wednesday because tomorrow Darlene and Claire and I will begin a road trip to Omaha and back. This is to celebrate the high school graduation of our nephew Stephen. Those of you who heard my interview with Stephen 4 years ago in TKC 102 may remember that he is definitely not a reader of books. In fact, he had never read a novel at that time. So I initiated a literary experiment with him by paying him $50 to read Ender's Game by Orson Scott Card on his sister's Kindle and then do a follow-up interview, which he did for TKC 119. My bookophobe nephew has gone on to do very well at his high school in the Omaha metro area, and he has been accepted at a highly competitive institution of higher learning, Creighton University in Omaha, though it's not clear yet if that's where he will be attending college. So Stephen is on his way in the world without even pretending to be someone who loves books on a Kindle or otherwise, and I am going to be following his college career beyond with interest. He's a great kid. He's a very intelligent guy and has a very unique swath that he's already cutting through the world, and the fact that he was candid enough to not pretend that he liked books any more than he does. He loves video games, and he's has quite a circle of friends around him that are always doing fun stuff. Really a remarkable kid, and I'm glad he's made it through high school and it seems to be going strong. Now, my guest for this week's interview is, by comparison, a book lover who has been cheerleading for literature high and low her whole career, including her current job as Amazon's editorial director for books. Sarah Nelson's team of 8 fellow book lovers chooses Amazon's best books list each month and undertakes other creative projects of curation to help us find great books to read.
The kinds of books that we call out, I mean, we do see that some of them go on to be successful. Did we call it or did we cause it? I don't know. And I wouldn't claim credit for it, but I am thrilled to be part of the conversation, and I think that writers and readers know that we are.
In news, I am going to use more than 140 characters to tell you about hashtag Amazon Cart, an innovative partnership between Amazon and Twitter. For the tech tip, I'm going to do a deep dive and tell you how you can tell if you have a first or second generation Kindle Paperwhite and what difference that makes. In content, I will follow up on the interview with examples of books currently highlighted by Sarah Nelson's team, and I'm going to point you to a promising new release by Stephen Pressfield and to a hot new Kindle Singles interview with author Tom Robbins. In news, there was quite a bit of coverage this week on an innovative partnership between Twitter and Amazon. It's built around a hashtag, which is a way to flag content on Twitter. You do a hashtag like the pound key on a typewriter, and then Amazon Cart, you include that in your reply if you see a tweet which contains a link to something sold on Amazon. Amazon has a video up which explains it, and I'll play that for you before telling you what my experience with it was.
These folks have a new favorite hashtag, Amazon Cart. Once your account is enabled, you can add millions of Amazon products to your cart without leaving your Twitter feed. With hashtag Amazon Cart, whenever you see a tweet with an Amazon product link, just hit reply and add hashtag Amazon Cart, and it will be waiting in your cart the next time you visit Amazon. Add it now, buy it later. It's that simple.
The spot goes on to talk about the really terrible inconvenience of having to leave your Twitter feed to go and buy something that you spot on in some kind of a tweet. And, you know, every time Amazon does something which takes some friction out of the buying process, it can seem just ridiculous because it's such a small incremental convenience. And they show a couple of people in bed and she's on her Twitter feed and, oh, wouldn't it be terrible if she had to actually leave Twitter and go buy something. But, you know, I think Amazon has shown over and over the genius of these small incremental improvements. Now, in my case, I found that it wasn't quite as simple as It was shown to be, when I tried it, first thing I discovered was that when I replied to a tweet that mentioned a book, a Kindle book, and I just hit reply and then hashtag Amazon cart, I didn't get the book added to my shopping cart on Amazon. Instead, I got an email saying that we did receive the Amazon cart hashtag from you, but it's only for physical objects. The digital products are not eligible to be added to your cart. So instead, they told me they sent a sample of the book to your last registered device, which in my case was Lens Keyboard 3G. You can try the sample first or purchase the book directly on Amazon by following the link below. And of course, Amazon being Amazon, it's an attractive email with a picture of the cover, a book that I have no intention of even taking a look at, C.S. Lakin's Conundrum. Might be a good book, I don't know, but that wasn't the purpose of this. Now, what was baffling to me is how come the Kindle keyboard was the last registered device, because I haven't used it for a long time, and I know I've registered my Paperwhite since then, and that's the one I read in addition to the Kindle Fire HDX 7-inch. So this necessitated a call to Amazon, and the solution that was offered was that I had to deregister my Kindle Fire HDX and then register it again. This actually caused some problems, and it's not. I hope that if you're doing this and you want to get these hashtag deliveries to your Kindle directly, that you're not going to have to go through that process. It messed up the what was on my Kindle Fire, and when I was over at the athletic club working out on the cross trainer, I couldn't get Hunger Games, which I had been watching, and it was just kind of a pain in the neck. But if that problem is solved, it's an intriguing process, and I've seen something, one commentator noted that this could be a real boon to independent authors. You know, sometimes my Twitter feed is just full beyond irritation with people who are marketing their books, and so now if you have a link to your book and someone wants to use this hashtag, then they will get a sample of the book sent to them on their device, and from there they can easily buy the book. So the customer moves a little bit closer to someone who wants to do that. I then did try it with a physical product, which I saw on Twitter. I think it was a Star Wars DVD set. And sure enough, I did the hashtag reply, and in my shopping cart, when I went to Amazon.com, it was sitting there ready for me to purchase, and it was pretty easy. I can imagine that this was a pretty tricky thing to set up, and as my experience shows, there are a few bugs in it, but I think it's a, I don't know, it's, for any of you who are not using Twitter, this is a completely pointless exercise in engineering and making things easier, but if you do use Twitter a lot and you see things in a tweet that you might be inclined to try at least a sample on a book, this is probably going to give you a slightly lower barrier to doing it, and who knows, that's liable to be a pretty big thing for Amazon. I have to say in passing here that when I had my problem with a Kindle Fire and I was working out this morning, I had an amazing May Day experience, and I've always been a big fan of the May Day button on the Kindle Fire HDX. This is where if you click on the May Day button, within a few seconds, somebody shows up on your screen in a little window. They can see your screen and they can help you out. So I'm on the cross trainer. I didn't have earbuds that would enable me to talk because I use the Apple earbuds with a microphone, and I'm sure there are earbuds I could buy for my Kindle Fire that would have a microphone built into it, but I knew that the tech person was going to be talking to everyone around me at the athletic club, but luckily there weren't too many people around me, so I thought I would risk it. So I'm huffing and puffing, and I tap the May Day button, and sure enough, a woman shows up to help me out. I don't know if she heard the huffing and puffing, and maybe she'd had been helping people in this situation before, but she didn't ask if I wanted to have her man the controls to try to find the Hunger Games. She just started moving around my Kindle and searching on the various places where I needed to go, and within I'm sure it wasn't more than a minute, she had the Hunger Games up on my Kindle Fire, and I was able to continue on with my workout. Now, it's just, I don't know, I've been using the Mayday button for a long time, but there was a situation where if I hadn't had the Mayday button, there's no way I would have called a phone number to get help with this. They wouldn't have been able to see my screen, much less they wouldn't have been able to navigate around my screen and do this for me. It felt like having a kind of electronic concierge at my beck and call to solve a, you know, very small problem, but one that, you know, I was able to finish watching the movie as during my 45-minute workout, and it was just marvelous. So if you've got a Kindle Fire HDX and you haven't tried that Mayday button, I urge you just to any excuse to try it, because once you start feeling the power of this means of technical assistance, you'll never go back, and it's pretty amazing. For the tech tip, I'm going to take a close look at the Paperwhite. And depending on when you purchased your Kindle Paperwhite, if you have one, that's Amazon's best-in-class e-ink dedicated e-reader, you have either a first-generation or a second-generation model. One of the most memorable moments of my interview with Jeff Bezos in July of 2012, when I interviewed him in Seattle, happened after I had turned off my Olympus recorder and had shown Amazon's CEO an example of the personal messages that we put on the Kindles that we distribute to U.S. service members through eBooks for Troops. He really seemed taken by it and expressed appreciation for it, and then he asked if I could not tell anyone about something he wanted to show me. Of course, I assured him, and it turned out to be a Kindle Paperwhite. This would be the first generation, of course. It was not going to be introduced to the public for another 42 days at a press conference in Santa Monica, California. I was astounded by the brightness of the screen, since all e-ink Kindles to that point had not offered a built-in light, except for cases that you could buy for them. So my memory of the first-gen Paperwhite is pretty vivid because of that moment in the little conference room with Jeff Bezos. I can't remember if he had it in his pocket, or it certainly hadn't been obvious during the interview, but all of a sudden he's handing me this thing, and he said, "I think you're about the third person outside the company to see this." So one of my white moments in doing this podcast. Now, the second generation Paperwhite was announced almost exactly a year later on September 3rd, 2013. The Wi-Fi only model was released for purchase on September 30th, and then the 3G model followed just in time for Christmas last year on November 5th. The all-new Kindle Paperwhite, as the second-gen model was touted, offered incremental improvements, including higher contrast e-ink, improved illumination, and a faster processor. The more detectable differences at that time were in software, because the second-generation Paperwhite included the X-ray bare-bones views of books, equipped with that feature, and integration with Amazon's prized new social reading acquisition, Goodreads. Except for one telltale design feature, you really can't tell the difference between the first and second generation Paperwhites, unless you're someone who can tell the difference that 0.2 ounce of weight makes in your hand. The second generation 3G model weighs 7.6 ounces compared with 7.8 ounces for the first gen 3G model. But there is a way you can tell them apart. On the back of the Paperwhite, if it says Kindle, then that means it's a first-generation model, and if it says Amazon, it's a second generation. Now, what happened, there were a series of updates to the software, and they still seem to be doing different things from each other. But I think that on March 10th of this year, I noticed that because Goodreads put up an item on their blog saying that as of that date, the Goodreads edition was available on both models of the Paperwhite, the Gen 1 and the Gen 2. And I think that the rest of the features that the more recent Paperwhite had were at that time folded in by the software update. I took a look at this, was trying to parse it out from the pages, but I did have to call Kindle support to verify it, and they got back to me and said definitively that at this point, there's no difference in what these two Paperwhites can do from a software basis. So now as the wheel turns toward probably another September when we might, based on past history, expect a third generation Paperwhite or perhaps an entirely new model of e-ink Kindles, the only difference between these two Paperwhite generations is the hardware. And I'm pretty sure most of us would be unable to detect the hardware differences, the most notable being that slight decrease in weight. I think maybe I talked myself into thinking I could see that the pages turned faster on the second gen model when I had a first gen and a second gen together. And you know, when you do that, you try to press the next button at exactly the same time, but I'm not sure you ever really can do that the way a machine would. But it's a very slight advantage. I'm sure the specs, they're telling the truth about the specs, but when it comes to the naked eye, then I think it's a little hard to see. At this, you know, a third generation Kindle Paperwhite, if it comes out with the same profile as the first and second, I suspect they'd want to make it evident that it's a third one, so they might put something different on the back cover. Maybe they'd say Paperwhite this time to show that it's a third generation. One thing I've noticed talking about the Paperwhite is how often people don't get the name right. And a common mistake is to call it the Kindle White. And I've heard others, I seldom hear people making the same mistake talking about the Kindle Keyboard or the Kindle Touch. So I hope if there's going to be a new model of the e-ink Kindle sometime this year, perhaps that they might come up with a different naming convention. One possibility would be to follow what the iPhone does. People don't seem to have any trouble remembering whether they have an iPhone 4 or an iPhone 5 or a 5S. So maybe Amazon could simply go with an overall Kindle generation number with letters to differentiate, say, the basic Kindle from the Touch, which were both introduced in what Wikipedia at least calls the fourth generation. That would make the next e-ink device the Kindle 7. That has a nice ring to it. And if there's more models, maybe a smaller, cheaper mini version, which I've always thought would be a good idea, that might be the Kindle 7M for mini, and an updated Paperwhite could be the Kindle 7P, and then go on from there. I think having a naming system which makes sense to people is a good idea because it helps them figure out which software updates they need to have on their Kindles in order to be up to date. I continue to use my Paperwhite second generation at night and for outdoor reading, and I love it. As the sixth generation, give or take, from the original Kindle, it has an amazing number of features added. And at this point, I suspect I'm not fully up to speed on it, even though I spend a lot of time working with it, especially through the eBooks for Troops preparation when we send them overseas. But I have found there's a great resource at Amazon.com, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes, that if you would like to venture up the learning curve for your use of the Paperwhite, I highly recommend taking a look at it. It's a series of video tutorials about how to use the Paperwhite, and they're only about 2 minutes each, and they're organized by specific aspects of the device. And here, I'm going to play one about the X-ray feature, which is something I think I'd like to talk about on a future show, because I'm really coming to value the ease with which it enables me to go back in a book and get information about characters. But here's the audio of the video tutorial about X-ray and how you use it on the Paperwhite.
If available for your book, the X-ray feature on your Kindle Paperwhite enables you to explore the bones of your book. While reading, tap the top of the screen to show the reading toolbar, and then tap X-ray. Filter by page, chapter, or book. The bars show all the locations in the page, chapter, or book where that character or term is mentioned. To learn more about a topic, tap the topic in the list. Here you can read a description of the character or term, follow links to Wikipedia or Shelfari, and read excerpts in the book that mention that character or term. Swipe your finger up and down to scroll through the list of excerpts. Tap an excerpt to go to that location in the book. Tap the back button in the reading toolbar to return to the topic description and list of excerpts. When finished, tap the Back button to return to the X-ray window and then tap the X to return to your reading.
Of course, you missed something there by not having the video, and they're very clear. They circle the buttons they're tapping on, and the visual information that accompanies that audio makes it a very quick learn. There are other videos on how to use toolbars and navigation on the Paperwhite, how to charge it, how to transfer books from a computer, how to restart or reset parental controls, how to buy and download books, keyboard and typing, how to use the virtual keyboard that shows up, and there's about 20 of these videos, and I think the longest is 2 minutes and 59 seconds, just 3 minutes, and that one is problems downloading content. I think that if you're enjoying reading on a Paperwhite, that's great. Darlene is certainly somebody I can never convince to explore some of these additional features. But I think these videos are so bite-sized and manageable that if you find yourself in an adventurous mood and you want to get slightly more out of your Kindle, I think it's worth its time very well spent. When Sarah Nelson left her position as book editor for the Oprah magazine in June of 2012, it was big news in the book publishing industry. Giga Ohm ran a Laura Hazard Owen story headlined "Amazon Snags Another Book Industry Vet, Sarah Nelson, formerly Publishers Weekly EIC." That's headline speak for editor-in-chief. She was the editor-in-chief at Publishers Weekly from 2005 to 2009, and when she was laid off from that job in a restructuring, it was characterized as astonishing in a story by the New York Observer. And the Observer article said, over the course of her 4 years at Publishers Weekly, Ms. Nelson has come to serve as something of a den mother for an industry that, on its worst days, seems to be crumbling. Her ubiquity on panels dedicated to the future of books and her largely unflappable public optimism about the health of the business has made her one of publishing's most visible cheerleaders. So my guest for the interview this week has a long pedigree in the book industry and various aspects of it, and she has been working for Amazon for nearly 2 years now as the editorial director for Amazon.com Books. I spoke with Sarah on Monday, May 5th by Skype and phone connection to New York, where she's based for Amazon. Our conversation took place shortly after she and her team had announced their selections for the best books of May. So I began by asking what sort of a mix their list aims at between the categories of fiction and nonfiction.
We try to make it as close to 50-50 as we can. We tend to lean a little towards fiction just because it seems like there's more fiction that comes out, more novels and short fiction that come out than nonfiction in any given month. But I think it's also partly our proclivities. We just tend to lean towards fiction, but we do try to keep a pretty close balance. I mean, it's one of the few sort of rules that we have about, choosing books is to, we'll look at a list and say, we don't have enough nonfiction here, it's one of the few, we'll look sometimes and say, well, we don't want every book on this list to be 800 pages, so we should find something. We try to keep a balance to keep in mind readers with different interests.
Yeah. Now, you've got one on this list that it was available for pre-order. I think it comes out tomorrow, Noble Hustle. Is that unusual that you would include a book that wasn't available to buy at the absolute first of the month?
It happens fairly often. We agree with the publisher. I think also the Glenn Greenwald book is not, I think it's out now, but I'm not sure that it was out on the first.
Okay.
But it's another one. When a book is embargoed, which the Glenn Greenwald was, I don't know that the Colson Whitehead book, Noble Hustle, was embargoed. It just wasn't available yet. It was slightly different. Embargo, as you know, is when a publisher has an obligation to a magazine or a website or a news organization that is going to run an excerpt, and they are bound, or television show sometimes, and they are bound to not let anyone else leak any information about it. That's part of their deal. So what we do sometimes, if we because we always come out on the first of the month and say this book, The Green Wall, I'm not sure, but I think it came out on the third or the fourth of the month. We go to them and we say, listen, you know, we won't say anything too substantive about it until the day it comes out, but we'd like to put it on the best. We'd like to look at it and consider to put it on the best of the month, because you're going to, you know, it's to everybody. It's a win-win for everybody. We'll be careful what we say. We won't give, you know, we won't share any spoilers. We won't, you know, give anything away. We won't compromise your deal, but we'd like to promote the book.
Right. Now, I assume there's no promotional considerations that go into these selections.
Yeah, you mean like co-op dollars or any of those things?
Okay.
Yeah, no. The publishers pitch us these books by the same way that they pitch them to other media outlets, and I've worked at a few of them where they send you the books or they come over to your office and tell you about the books that are coming out that season or that month, or then usually it's for a couple months at a time. They don't come every month. If you came over here and you saw the number of books that show up here unbidden every week, every day, we don't even necessarily tell them in advance that we're going to choose their books, but we and we look at things that they haven't pitched us to that we just sort of stumble on, or that because they can't necessarily pitch us every book on their list. So, you know, the easy way to do this job is to take the most promoted books from Random House and Penguin and Simon, you know, all the publishers, and that's your 12 books. But that's not the way we do it, because then it limits your discovery. And as readers, you know, what we all want is discovery. You always want to find that thing that nobody else knows about, that, and you feel like it's yours, you know. And so that's what we look at small press things. We look at things that, you know, just come to us in some weird way that somebody stumbles on. You know, a friend tells us about, I don't know. So we take recommendations from publishers, but we are not beholden to them.
So would you tend not to choose a book that was going to get massive publicity, like, say, Hillary Clinton's upcoming memoir? There's going to be no way anybody would not be able to discover that book. Are big ones like that just sort of not considered because of the purposes you're creating this list for?
I mean, that book is embargoed, you know, to within an inch of its life.
Right.
And I don't know that we can even consider it for the June list. I mean, that the publisher will let us even consider it without, you know, I mean, they won't even let us see it, you know, even jack a copy, I don't think.
Yeah.
So we like to help books, and we like to find, as I said, you know, have the pleasure of discovery and pass that pleasure of discovery on to readers. But if something that's a great big book, you know, the new Stephen King or the new, you know, J.K. Rowling, you know, if we see it and we really like it, we will likely put it on the list. We won't vote against it just because it's already going to be popular.
I see.
We try to really go with what we genuinely like.
Right. So what you like, and if you end up liking something that maybe people wouldn't have heard about, that probably makes it even more fun to put it on the list.
It's all the better. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Your position as editorial director for Amazon Books, you've been at it, I think, almost 2 years. How would you describe the editorial vision for books in print and Kindle for Amazon.com? You said that you looked forward to working on creating that editorial vision as part of taking on that job.
Well, I think that we have made great strides, if I may say, in making our work visible. I mean, I should say that there was a team, and some of the people are still here. There was a team of editors, and there were people who did Best of the Month and other editorial features. But what I think has changed in the time that I've been here is the visibility of those features and the quantity of them. I mean, there was always a Best of the Month. There were always Best of the Month features, and there was always Best of the Year. We've added a number of other things. We now have 100 books to read in a lifetime franchise. We've done two versions of it. One was a sort of general books list, and then just last week, I think, we launched Mysteries and 100 Mysteries and Thrillers, you know, the 100 Best Mysteries and Thrillers of All Time kind of thing. You know, we'll be doing that again with other kinds of books. And so we're doing a lot more curating and cataloging of books, creating lists, doing a lot more author interviews. We are, you know, we're responsible for omnivoracious.com, which is the Amazon Books blog that you can get to from the book's homepage. And we are working on a renovation, shall we say, of that to accommodate more and more material. We do a lot of interviewing. We do a lot of comparing books. One of the things I like to do is kind of, you know, this book is big right now. You know, it reminds me of three other books, you know, and so that we can kind of connect current books, brand new books, with older books, as I think readers do. I mean, it's like a little parlor game I play in my head, you know, because I've been reading so much for so long, you know. I'm always thinking back to something I read a few years ago that this was an outgrowth of or reminded me of or something.
You also said as you were taking the job that you're looking forward to expanding or being part of expanding book content at Amazon.com. Do you have any sense of how much expansion there has been of book content in the last 2 years?
Well, yeah, I mean, as I say, we've added these 100 best books of the year. I mean, sorry, 100 best books, 100 books to read in a lifetime franchise. We've done a number of what we call map features, 50 Great American Love Stories, where we chose a book about love or relationships that we did in February, obviously, for one from each state, you know, set in each state so that you would click on the state and get the book. We did Great American Eats, which was a similar thing, food books around the country.
Oh, I see. See, I thought I was taking that as expanding the number of books on the site, but you were referring to the amount of content about books on the site.
Right, yeah. Right. You know, and it ends up being, we end up talking about more books than we used to.
Yeah.
Because we find new ways to talk about them. This is kind of my thought. I really believe that what my team and I do here is, I mean, we are really passionate readers, and we really mean it. I mean, and we have, you know, let's say impassioned discussions, sometimes filibusters, around our books, and we really, really care about books. And, I feel like we do introduce readers to books that they might not otherwise see. We are very much a part of the conversation about books. We make a difference for writers. I mean, is J.K. Rowling successful because we put her book on the site? Well, no. I mean, I think she sort of predated us. But, you know, the kinds of books that we call out, I mean, we do see that some of them go on to be successful. Did we call it or did we cause it? I don't know. And I wouldn't claim credit for it, but I am thrilled to be part of the conversation, and I think that writers and readers know that we are.
You've had a chance to interact in some way with millions of book lovers through the Amazon.com site, and have you gained any impressions about what those people are after, or just a sense of the huge book reading audience that ends up checking out Amazon.com pretty regularly?
There are a lot of really passionate readers out there, and I am always, and I will say I found this in my other jobs too, that, you know, people talk about how, you know, there's nothing, you know, the book business isn't working, or there aren't great books, or it's not as good as it used to be. That's always the refrain. Mm-hmm. And from the letters that we get and the responses I've gotten, you know, and not just here, people are always looking for something to read. And when people love something, if you just go and you look at the Amazon customer reviews, these are people who are, you know, you may not agree with their opinions, and I often don't, but they're in there discussing it. So, and I'm always amazed at I mean, when we do the best of the month, for example, there are more books than we have room for. There are more books that we like. There are eight of us, and we all, it is the rare month that we have to scramble to find something we want to put on the list. I mean, we're usually having to sort of argue over something, and something's not going to quite make the list. So we're not short of stuff to read, and I think that the behavior of Amazon customers, you know, sort of proves that.
One thing which I heard a lot about when the Kindle first came out was the opportunity for social reading, that you'd be able to see what your friends are reading, and then using Amazon has a tool where you can follow people and their annotations show up in the book. But it doesn't seem like it's really caught on. And then the possibility of having books annotated by famous people. The Cheryl Strayed book had Oprah's notes in it when it came out in 2012, and I interviewed Cheryl, and she said that had been a big conversation for her to agree to have Oprah's notes in her book. But what do you think of that as an idea?
Well, I have to say that I should probably recuse myself from that, because I was working at Oprah Magazine, and I relaunched the book club with Cheryl Strayed's book, and I was in on all those conversations.
Was it your idea to have Oprah put the notes in?
No, I don't. I wouldn't say that. I honestly don't remember whose idea it was. I think, it was a technology that existed, and the general feeling was, you know, that we should make use of it. But, there were discussions back and forth about, you know, about whether people would want this or didn't want this. I mean, and I don't really remember with that book what the upshot was, whether, I remember that we did it, but I don't specifically remember who argued what. You know, I think some people like it, and it sounds like an obvious answer, but some people like it and some people don't. For example, with the last Oprah pick, the Sue Monk Kid book, there you could buy the book in Kindle in either form. Though you had the option, and it costs the same and all that. So you could either have it with Oprah's comments or not have it with Oprah's comments, depending. And, I think the people who like it, and the people who don't want it really don't want it. So, you know, for us to make it available in both forms seemed to be the best idea.
David Carr, a couple of months ago in the New York Times, wrote what I found to be a provocative and really interesting piece, because he basically admitted that the excess of excellence in television was altering his media diet and was reducing the number of magazine articles he was reading, and even kind of affecting the number of standby books that he's trying to read, just because House of Cards, Justified, Girls, some of these series have near literary pleasures that are drawing him away from books toward television. Are you experiencing anything like that?
With all due respect to my friend David Carr, I don't think that he ever read books at the rate that that I do. I mean, I certainly love those TV shows also, and I watch more television. I will say I watch more television than I used to. I was never a big network TV watcher, but I read an awful lot. I mean, I don't see that I read less than I used to, and I certainly don't see, I actually think that the success of those sorts of TV shows, I think David's right in that they provide a kind of, they have a literary quality, they come from a literary place, they have a narrative arc, they have character development, they have all the things that a great book has. I suppose they may take some people away from reading books. I think that they sort of put books back in the center of the conversation, in the same way that a movie made from a book makes people want to go back and read the book. I think it raises everybody's level of taste so that they expect, you know, a literary or a well-developed story, which they may then go back and find in a book.
Interesting. Plus, some of those top shows, they have a lot of literary references that sort of are pointing you back to books.
Sure. Well, and Girls is all about wanting to be writers, right?
Yeah, she's going to the Iowa Writers' Workshop next season, so that should be fascinating.
Right.
You've said that we ought to allow ourselves to stop reading a book at page 25 or 50 or even a few chapters from the end. I find that very difficult to do. Why is that a good idea?
Well, I think that as a reader, I mean, I will say as a reviewer, I don't allow myself to do that. I mean, I just want to be clear about that. I mean, I won't write about something. I think I actually said that in my book, too. I won't write about something I haven't read all the way through. And at best of the month, we have to have had two full reads of a book before we'll put it on Best of the Month. I mean, just because I love something, I got it. Part of my job is to cajole or convince other people on my team to read the books so that, you know, we'll have two strong readers and we could have more. And then we can also have people who have only read little bits of it, but we need to have two solid readers. I mean, I think in life, when you're reading for pleasure and, you know, your own entertainment or education, the education with a small e, you know, there are a lot of books, and if something doesn't appeal to you or you become, you know, done with it, you know, you should move on. I mean, you certainly don't owe it to, I think I always used to feel, and I think a lot of people feel that, you know, they owe it to the writer to read the whole book, and I think that's a wonderful sentiment, and I think most writers would appreciate that, but the reality is I just worry that if you force yourself to read something you don't want to read after having given it a chance, you are running the risk of resenting reading and thinking of reading as a chore. Oh, I have to go back and finish this book because I have to. I think that's sort of a slippery slope to be on, and I think you're better off moving to something that makes you happy to read it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense. And why do you think 3 to 5 a.m. is the best time to read a book?
Because I'm a terrible insomniac, and it's been going on for years. I read a half of a memoir last night at exactly that hour.
Do you find that books sort of have an easier way into your mind and your heart when you're reading in the middle of the night?
I don't know about that. I mean, I guess if I fall asleep reading, I guess that's telling me something about the book, but maybe not. Maybe it's really just telling me I'm tired.
Well, last question. Your mix of reading now, say the 50 books or so that you read last year, what would your guess be as to how many you read on a Kindle versus in print?
Well, easily half and half. I tend to, and when it's one of the perks of this job, I mean, I will often read the same book, you know, some of it on Kindle, and then switch to a paper book, and then switch back, because I have access to them in all forms. I mean, when I'm on the treadmill, I'm reading on the Kindle almost always, but then sometimes, you know, I feel like reading a paper book. So, you know, I've read a lot of books in both forms.
I have been speaking with Sarah Nelson, the editorial director for Amazon.com Books. Thanks very much, Sarah.
Thank you.
In content, I've carefully built a fair number of links to the curation projects that Sarah Nelson's team has available at Amazon.com. I'll say that after talking with her and realizing how carefully these are put together, I've got a new awareness for the resource that this provides to find books. And there's a lot of really fun things. They did one for Valentine's month on 50 love stories arranged by state. And for Massachusetts, it was love stories set at Harvard, but then some other ones as well. So you see a real flair in the way these books are chosen and distributed, and I think that it makes it enjoyable and a really good resource. Also in content, I want to mention Stephen Pressfield's The Lion's Gate on the Front Lines of the Six-Day War. That's just out on Kindle, and also there's a Kindle single, which is a long interview with Tom Robbins. He's a kind of an iconic author now, 81 years old, living in Laconia, Washington. He wrote Even Cowboys Get the Blues and Still Life with Woodpecker. Not coincidentally, he has a new book out, which he doesn't want to call a memoir, but it sure sounds like one. It's titled Tibetan Peach Pie, A True Account of an Imaginative Life, and you can pre-order it with delivery set for May 27th. That's it for this week. I'm not sure who I'm going to be interviewing next week. I'm working on one, but it hasn't quite come together yet, and the week after that, I'll be interviewing at Booktopia Boulder, which I'm really looking forward to. This is Len Edgerly for the Kindle Chronicles in downtown Denver. Thanks very much for listening to my podcast.